Welcome back to our Sunday school class on Encounters with Jesus. We're studying various episodes from the Gospel of Mark, and this time we're looking at a set of stories in Mark chapter 5. This is part of a larger catalog of stories that Mark puts together that all demonstrate Jesus' authority. So going back to in Mark chapter 4 when Jesus shows his authority over different realms, different elements. So in nature, he shows his authority over the storm, calming the storm at the end of Mark 4, shows his authority over demonic forces at the beginning of Mark chapter 5 with the Gerasene demoniac. And now we'll see his authority over disease with this woman with the hemorrhage, and his authority over death as he heals Jairus' daughter and raises her from the dead. Mark just continuing to emphasize the deity and lordship of Christ. So we're going to read a significant section of scripture here from Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 34. This is kind of the first installment of these two stories that are put together, sandwiched together by Mark. It says in Mark 5, 21, "And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, 'My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live.' And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. It was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, 'If I touch even his garments, I will be made well.' And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, 'Who touched my garments?' And his disciples said to him, 'You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, "Who touched me?" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease.'" Well, it's becoming more and more evident that we live in a culture where public humiliation is a way to punish people, minimize people, marginalize people. So we're becoming kind of this shame and honor culture, maybe not to the degree that some Eastern cultures are, but You hear it in the whole cancel culture where someone says something we don't like and there is this systematic social media dogpile on top of this person where they might lose their job, their career, because they have said something unpopular, something out of sorts with what our predominant majority culture thinks is important. This is all sort of a manifestation of shame. There was a young woman a couple of decades ago who experienced global humiliation after her youthful indiscretions, youthful foolishness, and the predatory actions of a powerful man were made public. Can you imagine that? Global disgrace. And now, 20 years later, this young woman says of that time, and if I said this young woman's name, all of you would know who it is, that public humiliation was excruciating. Life was almost unbearable. I felt like every layer of my skin and identity were ripped off, is what this young woman said. The shame sticks to you like tar. Shame sticks to you like tar. Feels like you're being skinned alive, this unbearable humiliation. These are some of the ways that people have used to describe shame. Shame feels like you've let the whole world down. You have experienced global failure. It's a brutal, full contact emotion, is how one person described it. It's a cosmic sense of embarrassment before God and others. Shame is often accompanied by the sense of shrinking or of becoming small and insignificant, a sense of worthlessness and powerlessness. The philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre called shame a hemorrhage of the soul. And you can see it in our story today, in a different context, of course, but here is this very pitiful woman. She had a hemorrhage of blood and a hemorrhage of the soul because she was ritually unclean, ritually disgraced, an outcast. She was untouchable. But Jesus is not ashamed of her, and he brings wholeness and healing to her life. He restores her publicly. That's often what accompanies shame, a sense of public failure, public humiliation. He removes that disgrace, removes that reproach. So both characters in our story, first we meet Jairus, and then we meet this nameless woman. Both of them exercise faith, but their faith is met with obstacles, with impediments, challenges. And that's what we want to talk about today, faith's impediments. We'll see that faith is deferred, first of all, and I'll explain what I mean by that, and faith is divulged, it's revealed. These individuals are given opportunities to voice, vocalize their faith in Jesus. So first of all, faith deferred. Sometimes faith gets put on hold, as in the case with Jairus here, where the answer is delayed. We pray, we vocalize our faith, and yet the answer is not forthcoming right away. The Lord makes us wait. Jesus has just returned from the eastern side of the lake, is what verse 21 says. He'd been expelled from the Gentile region because they were scared of him, they were afraid of him. Remember the story of the Gerizim demoniac and all of those thousands of pigs running down into the sea, and that local economy is on the verge of collapse. They're afraid of the Son of God. What more might he do? How else might he destroy our economy? And they expel him from the region. And now he's back in Jewish territory. He's greeted with this surging popularity. His popularity, his approval ratings are at an all-time high. This great crowd greets him upon his arrival. And Mark relays two stories. It's a bit like a sandwich. One story is placed within another, and the stories mutually interpret one another, or there are connection points, parallels between the two stories. So the outer bread of the sandwich, if you want to call it that, is the story of Jairus and his daughter, who is very sick at the point of death. And then the inner portion, the inner meat of the story, is the story of this unclean, hemorrhaging woman. And the connecting points are, there's a few here. The unclean woman has been sick for 12 years. Jairus' daughter is 12 years old. Someone in both parts of the story falls before Jesus. So Jairus falls before Jesus, begging for him to help. The unclean woman, after she's been healed, falls before Jesus and confesses the truth. Someone in both of the stories is referred to as daughter. So Jairus refers to his daughter as, "My daughter is sick, please come heal her." And Jesus refers to the unclean woman as daughter in the way that he restores her. They both have desperate circumstances. Both have ceremonial impurity involved, the woman with the issue of blood, and then Jairus with the corpse at the end of the story after his daughter has died. They both need Jesus. Well, Jairus is first in line, and he is this local VIP. This well-respected, educated man, verse 22 says he's one of the rulers of the synagogue. So he's a man of authority and standing in the community, a leader of the local religious life. So he, as a ruler in the synagogue, usually it was lay people who took this role, and he was used to exercising authority, telling people what to do, getting the synagogue ready for worship every week, maybe recruiting people to read the scripture or somebody to deliver the sermon, maintaining the buildings and the finances and the security. Jairus was probably accustomed to telling people what to do. Why don't you go polish that lampstand? Why don't you go empty that trash can? Rearrange those scrolls? Spruce up the meeting area? But his religious stature in the community could do nothing to save his daughter. He came to the only person who could help, and that's Jesus, the Son of God. And he falls at the feet of a carpenter from Galilee, his posture saying much about what he felt at that point, a sense of hopelessness, a sense of desperation. "My little daughter," he says, "is at the point of death." Now stop right there. That is enough to make anyone feel great compassion for Jairus, and especially if you're a father of a little daughter, as I am, you feel a great sympathy with what Jairus is feeling at this moment. His heart is breaking. His little girl is at death's door. Her condition is critical. We learn later on in verse 42 that she's 12 years old. So there's not a moment to lose. They must move quickly to Jairus' house if this little girl is going to be spared. I remember one of the young fathers in our church telling me when his little daughter was born that his heart just melted. That he said, at that point, what I wanted to do was just I wanted to hand over my wallet, my car keys, say, here's my money, you can have everything, you have captured my heart. And what loving father would not want to do anything for his daughter? And now to see her in this weakened state, this critical state, it's devastating for him. So Jesus says, yes, I will go with you. Verse 24, he went with him, accompanying Jairus to his home, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. Of course, if you get Jesus, you get the crowds. Crowds that are full of fawning, jostling people, massive amounts of people. So they can't go anywhere fast. They need to get there fast, but they can't. The crowd is choking off and suffocating Jesus' movements, the press of the crowd. He can't move anywhere quickly. Again, in Mark's gospel, the crowds are ever present, usually obstructing the path to Jesus, usually hindering progress, serving as impediments, obstacles, making it harder for people to reach Jesus. And the crowds were not always filled with genuine truth seekers. They were sometimes filled with people who just were amused by what Jesus did, amused by his ministry, maybe amused by his healings, wanted to be entertained. So here they are making their way to Jesus, to Jairus' house, and suddenly they are distracted. Jesus is distracted by something. Speed is of the essence. There is no time for delay. We'll get to, in just a minute, we'll get to the details of the unclean woman's story. But to Jairus' sheer horror, Jesus stops to ask, who touched me? So Jairus' urgent request is put on hold. If Jesus were like an ER physician and he suddenly stops treating Jairus' daughter to move on to someone else and neglects her, Jairus, you would think, might have sued Jesus for treating another patient while his daughter died. Jesus seems to be behaving erratically, irresponsibly, even recklessly, as he stops to ask who touched him. So here, faith gets, that's why I'm saying faith gets deferred. It's almost like he's getting the silent treatment. Jairus is asking for help, and the answer is delayed. Jairus feels that he's being ignored. We've all been there. We've all been put on hold. Maybe you've been at the DMV, and someone nonchalantly strolls in and cuts to the front of the line, and it raises the ire of everyone else in the line. Hey, take a number. Go to the back of the line. You call the cable company, and you want to speak with a real person, and you're put on hold, or you're sent to talk to the computer, to the digital phone system, and you have to wait. Many years ago when I was in seminary, I suffered a minor injury and had to be treated for it, and my health insurance was sorely lacking at that point. And the doctor's office ordered some medical tests, and hardly anything from those medical tests was covered by insurance. And so when the medical bills began to come in and began to pile up, it felt like I was constantly on the phone with the insurance company. And that company was vastly understaffed, and they were receiving volumes of phone calls. And before I could talk with a human being, I would often have to wait 20, 30, even 45 minutes. Incredibly frustrating. So you felt that. Jairus is feeling this right now, the frustration, the irritation, anger, all of that churning, all of that mounting. Why is he getting ignored? Why is this random woman in the crowd getting preferential treatment? Why has Jesus been redirected? Everyone coming to a halt. Could we say that this is a test? Will Jairus trust the master? Jesus has said, I will go with you. And almost as if Jesus moving in his direction to go treat his daughter is some sort of guarantee that yes, she will be healed. Yes, she will be dealt with. Yes, Jesus is going to help. You know, we may think at times that Jesus has forgotten us, but he doesn't love us any less. He's not giving preferential treatment. Sometimes his answer is yes. He deals with our problem immediately. Sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes the answer is wait, or sometimes it's not yet. Faith is deferred. Sometimes it seems to be put off or delayed. Will Jairus continue to trust the master? And then the second thing we see here is faith divulged. And this is the inner part of the story. This is the meat of the sandwich. The two stories interacting, interpreting one another, feeding off one another. Verse 25 says, and there was a woman. Now the fact that she's a woman in Palestinian society already marks her as a person of lower status. Here's Jairus, he's a VIP. He's an influential member of the community. She is not. She is unnamed. In typical Markan fashion, Mark gives the details of her ailment, the malady that has plagued her now for some 12 years. She was unclean, verse 25. She'd had a discharge of blood for 12 years, a chronic bleeding disorder, a personal, painful, embarrassing problem that's left her emaciated and isolated. She's isolated because she is in this permanent state of ritual impurity. No one can come near her. If anyone touches her, they're considered unclean. If she touches anyone, they're considered unclean. And they can't, they'll have to refrain from participating in worship practices. So her impurity is transmissible. And her discharge of blood has caused her to be discharged from society. So she's unclean. She's excluded. It's part of the sting of shame. The opening illustration I gave about the woman who felt that, who is still this young woman, because of her indiscretions, her foolishness, and the predatory actions of another person, a powerful person, she still feels the sting of shame now, several decades later, the isolation, the rejection, the communal reproach. This woman has been spiritually, socially isolated for 12 years. She has limited health care options. She had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse, verse 26 said. Some scholars have noted with amusement that in Luke's account of this story, Luke just states that no one could heal her. He doesn't say anything about physicians, Luke himself being a physician. Perhaps Mark is protecting his profession. Luke is protecting his profession, whereas Mark's reference says clearly the woman was suffering at the hands of many doctors. Doctors were not highly regarded in that day. The Talmud says that the best among doctors is worthy of Gehenna, which is the refuse pile outside of the city, where trash was burned. Doctors would have gotten 0 stars in their online reviews should they had them back then. They lacked skill. Patients distrusted them. Patients were worse off after going to them. Aren't you glad that you live in 2020 and have access to the medical care that we do, as imperfect as it may be? But the only thing that these physicians had succeeded in doing was emptying her life savings. She's suffering from both the disease as well as the cure. So she's moving secretly because of her risk of contaminating other people. Shame and secrecy often go together. We dread exposure. We dread that awful sense of global failure that accompanies shame. She had heard reports about Jesus. We probably wouldn't say that she had great, refined, nuanced theology, but she knows that Jesus is good. She knows that Jesus can help people. Maybe there's even a little bit of superstition mixed in here. She says, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well, verse 28 says. Rulers in the ancient world were believed to possess power to bless those who touched them. So Alexander the Great, for example, was often mobbed by crowds who ran to him from all sides, some touching his hands, some his knees, some his garment, in hopes of being his power, the aura that surrounded him, blessing people who could come near and be in close proximity to him. And so she makes her way stealthily through the crowd, knowing that if she touched anyone, that the recipient of her touch would be ritually unclean, she would be further stigmatized. So she's risking a lot here, isn't she? And she touches Jesus' garment, risking the contamination of Jesus. Jesus would now have to follow the rites of purification. He would be ritually unclean. But yet she is healed, as if her impurity does not transfer to Jesus. Verse 29, immediately the flow of blood dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed. And Jesus senses that healing power has left him. Did these healings drain Jesus in some way of spiritual energy so that he then needed to go and have times of rest and prayer? Jesus has this sensation of weakness, of draining, knowing that there has been a healing. He has lost something so that she might gain. He has lost power so that she might gain wellness and wholeness. The fundamental transfer of the gospel. Christ's sacrifice is our gain. He became poor that we through his poverty might be rich. He loses some of this power so that she might be made well. And so he turns to the massive jostling crowd all around him and says, "Who touched my garments?" The other disciples can't believe it. He's being touched and jostled by dozens of people in this crowd. And Jesus wants to know who touched him. What's Jesus doing here? He's pursuing her. He's going after this unclean woman because he wants to restore her. He's going after the outcast, the publicly reproached woman. And so he says, "Who touched me?" He's trying to draw her out. She must publicly acknowledge her actions to the whole crowd. She cannot be a secret follower of Jesus. Her faith must be divulged. And he is not content to just dispatch with a miracle and say, "Okay, you're healed. See you." No, he wants to encounter the person. His healing work is interpersonal. So Jesus invites her to stand publicly with him and allow him to remove that social ostracism, the rejection, the scorn that's been heaped upon her the last 12 years. 12 years of public humiliation and reproach. And Jesus has just now wiped it away and wants to publicly restore her. Initially, she's fearful. She's fearful of further criticism, fearful of further rejection. She falls down at Jesus' feet, publicly confesses what has happened. And notice how Jesus responds, "Daughter, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed." She is a daughter. Jesus addresses her as daughter. He names the shamed. She's no longer nameless. She is a daughter. She's considered part of the family of God. He publicly declares his love for her and his acceptance of her and his inclusion of her. He has pronounced her whole. And the whole village should now welcome her back into their religious and social life, drawing her out of hiding into the broad daylight. Her faith had saved her. She can now go in peace. Jesus' words there, "Your faith has made you well," would suggest both physical and spiritual healing. The woman's faith in Jesus for physical healing at the same time became faith in him for salvation from sin. So faith may face some impediments at times when we look to Christ. It may be deferred in the case of Jairus. He's compelled to wait for Jesus to act. The unclean woman was compelled to divulge her faith, to publicly identify with Christ, to become a genuine, committed follower of Christ. Bishop J.C. Ryle says this, "Faith brings an empty hand, receives everything, and can give nothing in return. By faith we begin, by faith we live, by faith we stand. We walk by faith and not by sight. By faith we overcome, by faith we have peace, by faith we enter into rest."